that statement that you just read, Amy, is fact-free. There was nothing there. Judge Marchand, to start with, was not handpicked by Alvin Bragg. It is a random system of signing judges in New York.
Well, in this case, though, Ellie, in this case, the reason that Marchand got it, apparently, is because he did preside over the case of Weisselberg and the Trump Organization, and Bragg made the argument that this is related. And so it didn't go through the random system, but it went because he randomly was chosen for that case.
Yeah, but Bragg didn't pick him. Bragg made an argument, and I'm saying that the random thing happened at the start of Trump world indictments, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, Marchand was randomly chosen for the initial Trump case, and therefore it makes sense that he's going to get all the rest. Bragg made that argument, but he didn't pick him, right? There's no ability for a prosecutor to pick the judge that they have. I mean, maybe Trump, because of how he went through impeachment, thinks that it's usual for people to be able to pick their own judges, but that's not actually how it works, right? So Bragg didn't pick him. Marchand did not railroad Weisselberg into taking that plea. Weisselberg took that plea because Weisselberg wasn't willing to flip on Trump. And so Weisselberg took the weight for the Trump Organization. That's how that went down. Like, this is a normal process. Okay, I can't say normal because it's not normal to charge former presidents. But to the extent that Trump is being treated like a normal defendant, this is what normal defendants face all the time. And quite frankly, I bet a lot of other defendants would love to be arraigned and then fly back to their golf club and give a press conference about why the charges are bogus. That doesn't happen for a normal defendant. So Trump is already taking advantage of the system in all the ways a rich, powerful, wealthy white man can. The idea that the assignment process is against him is just bunk. It's just not true.
I mean, it's very interesting, the attack on Juan Marchand, because it reminds you of the attack on another judge, on Judge Curiel. This was when President Trump was running for president the first time, and Trump University was being charged with fraud. And Judge Curiel, Judge Gonzalo Curiel, was the judge overseeing that case against Trump University in San Diego. Trump began calling him a hater who was being unfair to him, because the judge is, quote, Hispanic, because he's Mexican, and because Trump was building a wall. He put that all together.
Again, that works for his base, right? That kind of attack works for the people who are already on his side, which is why I disagree with a lot of the coverage that's coming from mainly mainstream media, mainly corporate media, mainly both sides media, that, oh, charging the president will rip the country apart. No, it won't. It won't rip the country apart. Trump has his base of crazy people, and they will continue to support him, and they will continue to believe the things that come out of Trump's mouth. The rest of us won't. That is already baked in to the system. So the idea that actually holding Trump accountable somehow further divides the country, are you kidding me? We cannot be more divided than we already are, where we have 30, 35, perhaps 40% of people actually believing this man, and the rest of us believing in, like, facts and truth and physics.
And Ellie Mistel, the call of a number of news organizations, from The Intercept to CNN, for Judge Marchand to allow cameras in this trial, that it is of serious public interest and the public is extremely interested. Your thoughts?
I always believe that we should have cameras in the courtroom. Courts should be, justice is best done transparently. Courts are houses of the public. I always think there should be cameras in the courtroom. I understand why some judges don't want them to be. I think they always fear of the way that the media circus can be created from these trials. And again, legal arguments are not, it's not like Law and Order, right? Like, they're dry and technical, and sometimes people who aren't knowledgeable about them kind of can get the wrong impression and take the wrong things, take the wrong lessons from them. That's why judges resist having cameras in the courtroom. But that's an argument. It's not a dispositive one. It's not a great one, basically. And I think in this case, as in every case, there should be cameras allowed in the courtroom. But it ain't my courtroom, so we'll have to see.
We're talking to Elie Mistal. He is the Nation magazine's justice correspondent. And, Elie, you wrote an interesting piece about another topic. Last Thursday, a federal judge in Texas blocked the Affordable Care Act mandate for health insurance companies to provide preventive care. Elie, you tweeted, FedSoc judge in Texas gutted the preventive care parts of Obamacare nationwide, so now the party of forced birth won't force insurance companies to cover basic prenatal care. Elie, you have a piece titled, "The GOP's War on Obamacare is Screwing Up Its War on Abortion." Talk about what's at stake here.
Yeah, so one of the most life-saving aspects of the Affordable Care Act is the fact that it forces insurance companies to cover preventative care. People forget, before the Affordable Care Act, it was actually very hard to get insurance companies to cover preventative care. So if you were poor or even middle class, a lot of times it was more cost-effective for you to get sick, because then your insurance would kick in. Trying to take steps to not get sick would be prohibitively expensive before Obamacare, right? So that's what Obamacare fixed. And of course, because conservatives don't like Obamacare and don't like that there was, you know, don't like the black person giving you health care. How did that happen? So the FedSoc judges, this one particularly, Reed O'Connor in Texas, who has made it his life's mission to destroy Obamacare, have gutted that section. They're basically three agencies that determine what is preventative care or not. O'Connor gutted one of them, and the task force that he gutted is the one that covers, among other things, cancer screenings, HIV transmission preventative drugs, and prenatal care. And the hypocrisy of these people, who want out of one side of their mouth will literally force women to give birth, to bring pregnancies to term against their will, but then won't force insurance companies to cover prenatal care.
And we're talking about birth control, right?
There are three organizations, institutions that determine preventative care. The one that pushed the contraception mandate, he didn't knock that one down yet, right? So there, one does what I'm talking about with prenatal care and cancer screenings. The other one does contraception. Another one does vaccinations. The contraceptions and the vaccinations institutions, those were left to stand. At this point so far, the one that does cancer and prenatal care, that one was knocked down by Reed O'Connor.
So what happens next?
Well, it gets appealed. I think
because it doesn't just come out right away for people who are afraid, because Obamacare is actually forward funded, right? So this funding goes forward for a year or so before that judge could be blocked.
I don't know. I'm not sure about the timing. It could happen faster than you're saying. I'm not sure about the timing. But the point is that this will be appealed, and then we'll have to see if a higher court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in this situation, which is a extremely conservative court, whether or not they stay or block the ruling pending the appeal of the case. We don't know that yet. Hopefully they do block it, because this is a judge who doesn't just have a history of trying to take down Obamacare. He has a history of being wrong. This is one of the few conservative judges that is so far to the right that even other conservative courts routinely overrule him. So one would hope that this latest conservative wackadoodle ruling is temporarily blocked until there's a full appeal, where he will likely be overruled.
Elie, before you go, on Friday, a federal judge in Memphis, Tennessee, temporarily blocked a law signed by Tennessee Governor Bill Lee banning drag performances in public. Meanwhile, in an interview on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, the far-right Republican Congress member Marjorie Taylor Greene said she stands by her claim that Democrats are a party of pedophiles. This is what she said.
The Democrats are a party of pedophiles. I would definitely say so. They support grooming children.
They are not pedophiles. Why would you say that?
Democrats support, even Joe Biden, the president himself, supports children being sexualized and having transgender surgeries. Sexualizing children is what pedophiles do to children.
Wow. Okay.
That was Leslie Stahl questioning Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's headed to New York to protest the arrest of Donald Trump. Ellie Mistel, your final comments.
Yeah, Amy, I'm going to push back on the word that was Leslie Stahl questioning. That was Leslie Stahl laundering Marjorie Taylor Greene and her wackadoodle theories. If Leslie Stahl had been prepared for that, which we knew that Marjorie Taylor Greene was going to say, Leslie Stahl should have been prepared to just come back with Denny Hastert, who's a Republican. The point is not Leslie Stahl. The point here is that Tennessee's drag ban was always bad law. It was always against the First Amendment. One of the things that these Republicans are trying to do is to directly attack the First Amendment when it suits them, to try to push their bigotry against the LGBTQ community. It was obviously against the First Amendment. It was a good decision by a judge to block it. And and even with our conservative courts, I expect generally that law to not pass muster and to be blocked all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Ellie Mistel, I want to thank you for being with us, the nation's justice correspondent, author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. We'll link to your recent articles, including Donald Trump Has Been Indicted, Don't Get Your Hopes Up, at democracynow.org. Coming up, we go to Belgrade, Serbia, where we'll speak with former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Adaifi, who gives his first television interview about how likely presidential candidate Florida Governor Ron DeSantis personally watched him be force-fed and tortured while DeSantis was working as a Navy attorney at Guantanamo. Stay with us. By Death From Above, 1979. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As former president and 2024 presidential candidate Donald Trump prepares to be arrested in New York on Tuesday, we turn now to look at a growing controversy about one of Trump's likely presidential opponents. That's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, widely expected to seek the Republican nomination for president. Prior to entering politics, DeSantis served in the Navy as an attorney at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo and in Fallujah, Iraq. DeSantis's time at Guantanamo is coming under scrutiny after a former prisoner named Mansour Adaifi revealed that DeSantis had personally witnessed him being force-fed and tortured. Other prisoners have backed up Adaifi's count. Last month, DeSantis denied authorizing force-feeding at Guantanamo.
The Washington Post did a big deep dive on this today, actually, about what you did out there. One of the things they said was that you authorized the use of force feeding.
That's not true. Yeah. Force feeding
the detainees who were on hunger strike. Was that true?
So I was a junior officer. I didn't have authority to authorize anything. Mm-hmm. There may have been a commander that would have done feeding if someone was going to die, but that was not something that I would have even had authority to do.
So that's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Ron DeSantis last month in an interview with Piers Morgan. But in an interview 5 years ago, in 2018, DeSantis admitted to CBS Miami that he'd authorized force feeding.
I was a legal advisor.
For those that were doing
the things that would happen is the thing you notice the day you get down there is for these detainees, the jihad was still ongoing. Right. And they would wage jihad any way they can. Now, they're in a facility, so it's limited. But some of the things they would do hunger strikes. And you actually had three detainees that committed suicide with hunger strikes. So everything at that time was legal in nature one way or another. So the commander wants to know, well, how do I combat this? So one of the jobs of the legal advisor would be like, hey, you actually can force feed. Here's what you can do. Here's kind of the rules of that.
That was Ron DeSantis in 2018 as he was running for governor in Florida. Well, with DeSantis expected to soon launch a run for the White House, we're joined by former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Adaifi. At the age of 18, he left his home in Yemen to do research in Afghanistan. Shortly before he was scheduled to return home, he was kidnapped by Afghan warlords and sold to the CIA after the September 11th attacks. He was jailed and tortured in Afghanistan, then transported to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in 2002, where he was held without charge for 14 years, many of those years in solitary confinement. Mansour Adaifi now joins us from his home in Belgrade, Syria. In 2021, he published a memoir titled Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. Mansour Adaifi, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Hey, hi, Amy. Nice to see you again. Good morning, America.
It's great to have you with us. You're actually speaking to the world right now at democracynow.org. You were detainee 441. Explain your connection to the current Florida governor, DeSantis.
That back to 2006. As you know, like, let me give a brief introduction. So why we went on hunger strike in the first place. As you know, we were transferred to Guantanamo, spent years without any kind, like, until now, without kind, like, charges or rights and so on. By the end of 2002, General Jeffrey Miller arrived and he turned the Guantanamo into an experimenting lab. And the situation got only worse every month and every year. By 2005, we managed to organize, like, a mass hunger strike that embarrassed the U.S. government. The Camp administration at that time tried to negotiate with us to stop the hunger strikes so they can improve the living condition in the camp. We agreed, but it was just they were buying time. By the beginning of 2006, a new medical team, a new camp staff arrived. One of them was a young, handsome officer who came to talk to us and told us he was there to ensure that we were being treated humanely. And we talked to them about why we were a hunger strike, what were our demand. It wasn't jihad, as he said, like, and, you know, what people always try to turn our actions in Guantanamo as, like, a jihad or Al-Qaeda activist cell, that way used to tell us all the time. So these were our demands, stop the torture. We were asking for them to improve the living condition in the camp, and he was talking to us and assured us that everything will change and he will make sure that we'll be treated humanely. Only 2 months, even less 2 months later, we were dragged to black solitary confinement, different camps, different blocks. A new medical team arrived and they start forcing feed us. And I'm not saying no problem with the force feeding. The use of the force feeding as a mean of torture. You know, I was taken to non-farmer block in camp 2. I was tied to a force-feeding a chair. Like, I couldn't move at all. I could only breathe. Guards bring piles of insure. And they started with the nurses pouring can of insure one after another. Like, the only way, like, you eat. So during the feeding, a group of officers arrived with the interpreters, with the interrogators, camp staff, medical staff. They were behind the fence. And I saw one of them was Ron DeSantis in a military uniform. And he was, while I was screaming, yelling, because I couldn't breathe of the insure and was like, I was bleeding because they really insert a thick tube through my nose. So I was like calling them, asking, and he was actually laughing, looking at the other officers and smiling. So this is my first encounter, second encounter with the Ron DeSantis. The first before the force feeding, he came to talk to us and other prisoners. Second time, I saw him like twice while on the force feeding. And like I would like to highlight really important things here. He was there. He wasn't there like to give orders. He wasn't involved directly in the force feeding. I didn't see him give any orders to the guards, but he was there, like supervising, watching. When I asked other prisoners who were also in the first feeding, if they saw him, they said yes. One of them, at least, he told me, he sent me a message. He said he was there, too.
Mansoor, we're also showing images of your remarkable artwork, your drawing of being force-fed as you speak. But I wanted to turn right now to another former Guantanamo prisoner who Democracy Now! Reached last week, Ahmed Ould Abdelaziz, who also remembers Ron DeSantis at Guantanamo. He spoke to us from Mauritania.
DeSantis. He was there, that person called DeSantis, because we didn't recognize his name until we saw him in the media. And then we heard about he is now working in the Congress, a guard who was working, very long time ago. For us, he's a guard, you know. For the government, he's a lawyer, and he came there. But he's doing the same thing as a guard because he was sided. He was siding with the guards. He was siding with the administration there. He was part of that. He was the link of that chain of involvers, people who were involved in injustices, wrongdoing, and mistreatment of detainees, putting people, detainees, in degrading conditions, degrading locals, because many of these blacks were not suitable for animals, not say about humans.
So that's former Guantanamo prisoner Ahmed Ould Abdelaziz speaking from Mauritania. He was released in 2015. Mansoor, you also contacted former Guantanamo prisoners via WhatsApp to see if they remembered Ron DeSantis. For our TV viewers, we're showing the screenshot of one of the people who responded to you who wished to remain anonymous. His message says in translation, quote, "Yes, I remember him. He was in detention with a group of officers who hurt and tortured us a lot. May Allah publish them all." I assume it means may Allah punish them all. Can you talk further about how the force feeding felt? And if there were any guards who were doing this to you or the people, you can tell us who they were who were putting in these tubes, who objected?
You know, this is different between the force feeding and using the force feeding as a means of torture. I spent years on force feeding. Some prisoners spent between 2 to 15 years on force feeding daily. Usually we get twice a day, in the morning, in the afternoon or night. Also, during Ramadan, they will do it, like, after sunset. There was, like, medical professionals. They were, like, nurses, doctors. But in 2006, and if readers go to my book, I talk particularly about what happened in 2006. It was one of the worst years in Guantanamo, where DeSantis was there. They started by punishing prisoners in Camp 5. Then they tortured the hunger strikes by force feeding. Also, Camp 4, a medium security camp, was raided and detainees were shot and hospitalized. 3 detainees died this year. Then, by the end of 2006, a new camp was opened, like Camp 6. So, in 2006, when Ron DeSantis was there during the torture by the force feeding, they really brought thick tubes called 18 French or 25 French with the metal tip, and they just push it on our nose. Guards used to do that too, because guards and medical staff, were there doing the force feeding. I got fed 5 times a day. They left me all night on the force feeding chair, and they give us some kind of laxative liquid in the nutrition liquid. So while sitting on the force feeding chair, we were in ourselves, and they left us like that. When they move us to solitary confinement again, they left us only with shorts, really cold cell. And the second day they will start again, like leave us 4 hours. We couldn't last some for 3 days, 5 days, and we had to stop. So they ensure they bought like boxes, 5 boxes or more, and the first feeding bag, what they just pouring in care and sugar one after another. I felt I was really drowning. On one of the first feeding, when I was like throwing up, yes, Ron DeSantis was there behind the fence, and camp officers, they were behind the fence. When I was throwing up, the insurance was too much in my stomach, so I threw at them, and they jumped back. They were killing themselves, looking at me. So I felt I did something at least, you know, worth it. So on one of the first feeding, while I was throwing up, the tube literally came out of my mouth. I remember the nurse grabbed it from the tube and it's like, start to eat. You have to start to eat. So that lasted for me for 5 days, and I had no choice. Like, I couldn't last, either like die or stop the hunger strike, and we stopped. I was first fed again in 2009, 2013, but that time they did it professionally, and we had no problem. We cooperated with them. The only time the force feeding was used as torture in 2006. There was also another years where some medical team, they will try to pressure us, you know, like to stop the hunger strike, but not as bad as in 2006.
In 2006, lawyers for another prisoner argued that the military made the force feeding process unnecessarily painful and humiliating to break the hunger strike. At the time, something like 100 of the prisoners were on hunger strike. I wanted to ask you why you think that Ron DeSantis, now the governor of Florida, has hardly mentioned his time, his experience at Guantanamo in his new book, The Courage to be Free, and also ask you about his time in Fallujah, which is very interesting. Going back to Iraq, you have— He arrived in 2007, right after he was at Guantanamo, during the surge. According to the Tampa Bay Times, DeSantis served as a senior legal advisor to the SEAL who commanded Special Operations Task Force West in Fallujah, Navy Captain Dane Thorlefson. Talk about the legacy of Fallujah.
First of all, he didn't mention much about his time in Guantanamo because we knew he was part of GTF and he was a legal advisor. And if you ask me, I think DeSantis is a cruel person. I believe that his mission there was a cover up to cover up what happened in 2006. So about Fallujah, I don't think I'm in a position to comment in his time there. But for what I have read and seen, that as we all know what happened in Fallujah, like death of civilians using depleted uranium and so on. So I would like to say one word to Americans, just watch out from that person. You know, is someone who bend the truth to serve his own political interest.
Mansoor, we're going to do a second part of this interview and post it at democracynow.org. You just wrote a comment is free op-ed piece in The Guardian about a Biden administration decision around the artwork of the Guantanamo prisoners. And we're going to talk about that and also show more of your images that you drew while in Guantanamo. Yes, Mansoor Daifi is a former Guantanamo prisoner, detainee 441, imprisoned without charge for 14 years and 7 months before being released in 2016 to Serbia. We spoke to him in Belgrade. His memoir is titled Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Go to democracynow.org for more information. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.